Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last month, Bob Sternberg took over as the new president of the University of Wyoming. In recent weeks, he's explained that he wants UW to attempt to be an inclusive university that does not focus on things like a student's ACT scores, and rather looks at the whole package. President Sternberg says making sure students are properly prepared for higher education and their future is much more important than test scores. He joins me to discuss a variety of topics.
One of the things that our state's struggling with, and I don't know how much you know about this, but they've been trying to get a handle on school accountability. They've been trying to get the curriculums maybe upgraded across the state with a local control state. That is tough to do sometimes, but they're trying to step that up. Will that go hand in hand with what you're hoping to see?
I think that accountability is very important in everything we do. I just think we have to think a little bit more broadly about what accountability means. Is it only scores on standardized tests, whether it's for elementary or secondary school or college, or is accountability that we're developing the kind of future workforce that is going to move the state of Wyoming forward in the United States and in the world? And if you're talking about a future workforce, it's not just test scores.
So what are they missing? Would it be, in your view, setting up a curriculum that gets them, I guess, exposed to all these different things, making sure they're doing the extracurricular activities by the time they hit UW?
Extracurricular activities are very important, I think, because they're part of preparation for life. If you ask adults, what is the most memorable experience from high school or from college, almost no one, in my experience, no one says, oh yeah, I was sitting in a lecture and boy, was that a great lecture. What they remember is participation in athletics or being a spectator in athletics or student government or journalism or a personal interaction with a teacher, a really good mentor, or some kind of active learning lab experience or field experience. So what I think is really important is to have the kinds of experiences that are life-changing. That's not to say that in-class lecturing or discussions don't matter. Of course, they do matter. But we need to think more broadly than just a narrow academic focus.
University of Wyoming President Bob Sternberg visiting with us. I want to ask you a little bit about an issue that's been a problem at UW for a while. It's been retention of freshmen and making sure that they can hang in. How do we change that?
I just talked to the deans yesterday about retention, about 76%, and that's not terrible. But what I asked the deans is, could we work in the next couple years to move that up to 80 or above? And I think we can do better on retention. Let me say why. If you look at why students drop out, I think there are three big classes of reasons. One is academic preparation is not as good as it could be. The second is financial reasons, that they either don't have the money or they don't know how to spend the money. They don't have experience with financial things. The third is what I call engagement. It's making the connection between college and your life later. And if they don't see a connection, sometimes they become disengaged because they don't see why they're doing it. So I think that by having more counseling with respect to academic preparation, financial resources, and engagement, we can do better. If you then break down the academic preparation, part of it is maybe they don't have the background from high school. Part of it is what I call learning the ropes. It's understanding what it means to be a college student. Just like when you go into a business, most of what you need to succeed isn't stuff you learn in a classroom. It's the ropes. It's the practical common sense of being a college student. The third issue is self-regulation skills, how you spend your time and resources. The fourth is essentially believing in yourself, resilience in the face of failure. My first grade in college was an F. And how do you keep up some kind of self-esteem in the face of bad feedback? And the fifth is connection, that you feel academically connected. And so what I'd like to do is we have a program called Synergy, expand their program so that we're reaching any first-year student who needs assistance. In my last job at Oklahoma State, about 30% of our students were involved in a program we set up. We called it LASSO there. And I'd like to see a good third of our students seeking help to ensure that they stay in college and can have the kind of later success that everybody wants them to have.
Do you target certain students? I mean, are you looking at something that says, yeah, we really want this person, we want Bob Beck to be in that program?
Bob, if you want to be in the program, I think it's never too late. But what we have been doing is primarily targeting students who are admitted with so-called support, which means students who don't quite make the usual requirements. What I would like is to have a broader view of this where you target students who need support. Or what we did is at Oklahoma State is we set up a system whereby any professor or teacher could identify a student who he or she thinks needs help, and then they're contacted and asked if they want help. And the third source is self-referrals. So I think that we can get a much broader entree to this kind of program so that every student in the first year who needs help can get it.
You've spent a lot of time talking about ethics in recent weeks. This seems to be a big issue with you. How will the university maybe try to incorporate into that into the learning experience?
Well, first let me say why I think ethics is so important. In my field of psychology, and one of the things I study is leadership. I also teach it. I've taught a course on leadership to undergraduates for the past 8 years. If you look at failed leaders in our country, national leaders or business leaders or educational leaders, even leaders in the church, if you look at failed leaders, they rarely fail because of grades and courses or because their IQs are too low or because they didn't go to a prestige school. They fail because of either lack of ethics or foolishness. They're just plain foolish. In terms of how you could develop it, what I'd like to see at the University of Wyoming is what I would call an ethical leadership track. And what that means is regardless of what you decide to study, you can take courses that are specially starred or signified that infuse ethical case studies in the given discipline into your instruction. So it's not having separate courses, and it's not having some kind of abstract, highfalutin, you know, here are ethical principles. It's rather, what are the kinds of ethical situations you confront in this field, and talking about how you address them.
With any luck, I'll capitalize on your effort to get a pay raise to the University of Wyoming. So I've declared my conflict of interest there. But let me ask you about that, because this really does seem to be a very serious issue. You've got some faculty and staff who are starting to leave the university. How are you working to maybe get legislators convinced to maybe sign off on this once and for all?
Well, in the roughly 1 month I've been here, a lot of my time has been spent meeting with the governor and legislators and other citizens in the state to explain why a pay raise for University of Wyoming employees is actually my number one priority. Why do I think it's important? Well, you can look at things like comparisons to other universities, but to me, that doesn't quite capture it. A university is a business. It's an educational business, and I think it's a wonderful business, but it's a business. And so you know if you're succeeding with your employees in a fairly simple way. Are they leaving? If you're the CEO of, say, Coke, and you see your employees going to Pepsi, all the abstract comparisons in the world don't matter. Something's wrong. And what we see at the University of Wyoming is our top employees are leaving to go to competitors that are good or excellent. But they're our best teachers and they're our best researchers, is shown by the numbers of grant dollars that they're receiving and the kinds of publications they do. And so we're in the position of coaxing our employees go to Pepsi. And we have to stop that if we want to be a top land-grant university. Everybody knows who has a job that when your morale goes downhill, people don't do their best work. And we have a serious morale problem here at the University of Wyoming, and I'm really committed to resolving it.
Yeah, and maybe just to follow up on both of those, so how bad of a situation is it with people leaving right now?
every year over the past 5 years, the number of people leaving has increased, and it's increased roughly linearly. So you could say, you know, again, I'm into hard data. You know, you can talk about, well, this is bad for morale, and I think that's important. But if every year the number is increasing and they're your best employees, so you have essentially an upward linear trajectory, that's a problem.
And how bad is the morale, have you sensed?
The reason I say the morale is really pretty bad is that any group I speak to, the first thing that comes up is salaries. And there are lots of things they could raise first. And, you know, it's just common sense. If you haven't gotten the raise for 4 years and you're now in the fifth year and you're working hard and you've got a family to feed and you've got a mortgage payment or a rent payment and you've got to buy food, we're just not keeping up with the times.
President Sternberg, we appreciate the time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
When we come back, we'll hear about a program to help get Latinas in Jackson ready for college. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Roughly 3 years ago, two women undertook an effort to take a group of middle school girls in Jackson under their wing with the goal of helping them get into college. The effort is called College Bound Latinas, and the program has had some early success. But a recent interaction with a University of Wyoming professor is taking the girls even further, as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Because of the large number of tourist-related jobs in Teton County, the Mexican population has been increasing over the last 20 years. It's led to a large influx of Latino children into the school system. But because they are learning a second language and adapting to a new culture, some of them have struggled. A few years ago, local Head Start director Letty Lira and Isabel Zumel from the Teton County Library decided to start a new group called College Bound Latinas to try and address the problem. Their goal was to take a group of seventh grade girls and help them get into college. The plan was to work with the girls over the summer. Lira remembers that some thought their idea was crazy.
Many of the adults that we had around us told us, these girls are never going to come. They're never going to show up on Saturdays. On a summer, this is not going to happen.
Not only did it happen, but the 13 girls who initially showed up were very enthusiastic.
What they needed were high expectations, and they needed positive attention as well.
Student Kelly Mars says the positive attention was lacking in the school district, and the personal interaction made a big difference.
Before I met Letty and Isabel, I was, like, so lost. I knew that school was really important for me, but this time I'm not lost. I know what I want to do, and so they have really helped me in that.
In an effort to introduce them to college life, the College Bound Latinas then came to the University of Wyoming and were invited to interact with a class taught by Educational Studies professor Aurora Chang. Chang was impressed with the girls, and it led to the development this summer of an intensive writing program called the Emerging Latina Scholars Intensive Writing Institute. It took place during 5 days in June.
And many of them were quick to tell me that they hadn't written that much in pretty much all of the time that they had been in school. And so originally they weren't too happy with me.
Student Laura Perez says that Chang's approach caught them off guard.
So first she made us write just free writing, and she read them. The next day she technically told us that our writing sucked. That just made us hate her a bit because no teacher has ever told us that.
But it had the desired result.
So that just made us push ourselves even harder to just write better and look at our work and see what we did.
The girls wrote a 10 to 12 page personal biography along with other writing activities. They even read and analyzed college level articles. Kelly Mars admits she learned a lot and improved, even though writing is not something she generally enjoys.
I like writing a little bit more, but not that much.
Chang says, though, that her tough approach will help.
In the end, they understood the value. It's not about liking folks. It's not about liking me. It's about you all getting to college and us doing whatever it takes to not only get to college, but also persevere through college.
By the way, Chang says the girls improved immensely and says they responded well to the challenges.
I think they are really intelligent, and they understand that good things take really hard work.
The girls will be in 10th grade this year. Chang is including them in her personal research, and she does plan to challenge the girls even more in coming years. Co-founders Letty Lira and Isabel Zumel says that they plan similar programs with other students in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
With Congress in recess for the month, President Obama is preparing to continue pressuring Republicans to work with him on job creation. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that Wyoming's congressional delegation says that while his speeches rev up his base, he still isn't trying to work with the GOP.
The president is planning to use August to hammer the GOP on jobs. He wants to lower corporate tax rates while also expanding some tax breaks for smaller businesses. Then he wants to infuse that extra revenue directly into the economy, investing in construction projects and community college job training programs. The president is blaming Republican leaders for blocking his jobs proposals.
I'm just going to keep on throwing ideas out there to see if something takes. I'm going to lay out my ideas to give the middle class a better shot. But now it's time for Republicans to lay out their ideas.
By lowering corporate tax rates, the White House wants to attract trillions of dollars held overseas by U.S. companies back onto American soil. From the sound of the president, you'd think his proposal is the only one floating around in Washington, which Wyoming senior senator Mike Enzi didn't care for. That's because he's already introduced legislation to help attract more investments in the U.S.
You know, a lot of times he's asked us for our ideas. I haven't seen him take anyone's ideas yet. And it's always disturbing to me if he rails on us for not doing them when we've given him ideas and they're not accepted.
As for the details, the president's plan drops the corporate tax rate from 35% to 28%. Enzi's plan would drop the tax rate on foreign income to below 20% and allow a one-time 10.5% tax rate on foreign earnings to get that money back in the U.S. economy. Enzi says if the president were serious about wanting to work with Congress, he'd get off the stump and start hashing out details on proposals like his.
It's the only one that's already in legislative form. Companies are very interested in it. It provides some penalties if they don't bring their money back.
Enzi says the reason it's hard to work on such legislation is that the president and Democrats have a different view of the role U.S. companies play in the global economy.
The president would like to make sure that no business is done in other countries, that it's all done in the United States. And that's just not a real-world principle.
The president's new proposal leaves the issue of individual tax rates off the table. Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis supports corporate tax reform, but she says focusing on that alone falls woefully short of what the country needs.
We're missing out on all the small business people, 80 or 90% of whom file their taxes as individuals rather than as corporations. So if we're looking at some tax reform as a means to stimulate economic growth and create jobs, we should be applying it not just to big corporations, but to the small mom-and-pop businesses that file their taxes as individuals. So that's a big concern.
The debate over individual tax rates is a part of the reason the two parties stopped negotiating and allowed sequestration to indiscriminately slice through the budget of most every federal agency. Even though it's a contentious issue, Lummis says the president should engage Republicans on it.
Oh, he shouldn't give up on that debate. Quite frankly, we should be advocating for more flatter rates and a more comprehensive reform for everyone. It is those people striving to be in the middle class and those already in the middle class that are the most impacted by this sluggish economy.
Before Lummis and her Republican colleagues left Washington for their August break, they took their 40th vote to repeal all or part of so-called Obamacare. Colorado Democratic Senator Mark Udall says it's good the president is trying to refocus Congress on the most pressing issue facing the country.
But the key here is that the economy needs our focus. We've got to remain committed to job creation.
But the president's call to infuse new tax revenue directly into the economy is also being met with skepticism by Lummis and other Republicans.
Past stimulus efforts have not succeeded in pulling us back to a robust economic growth situation. Leads me to believe that that is money that would not be well placed. So given that approach to a bill that the president is espousing, I find it hard to believe that we could find compromise.
Throughout August, the president will continue pounding the GOP over the economy, while back at home, Republicans will do the same. That means when lawmakers return to work in September, a polarized Washington may reach a boiling point. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll look at why politics could be influencing scientific studies, and we'll hear about Wyoming's efforts to control invasive species. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Today, the long-awaited groundbreaking for the $41 million Wind River Job Corps took place. The project was first conceived in 2005, and thanks to support of Senator Mike Enzi, it finally received federal approval. It is the first Job Corps for Wyoming, which is the only state without such a facility. Sandy Barton of the Fremont County Board of Cooperative Education Services, or BOCE, spearheaded the effort from the start. She told me that it will have a major impact on Fremont County and the state.
Well, the purpose of the Wind River Job Corps is to help economically disadvantaged, at-risk young adults to become responsible, employable, and productive citizens. And at the Job Corps site, they provide them with different kinds of opportunities to increase their vocational or their career and technical skills, as well as strengthen their educational, and a unique thing is their social skills also that they need to succeed is also addressed at the Wind River Job Corps. So, again, it's for those economically disadvantaged youth, and we currently don't have any kind of center or educational place in Wyoming that offers this kind of training.
Obviously, when we've talked in the past with the reservation right there, that seems to be a pretty good fit for Fremont County. But your view is to go beyond Fremont County. This is a statewide effort, right?
Well, it will focus and serve the youth of Fremont County. It will also stretch all across Wyoming into all of our school districts and all of our youth. And then also, after the priority of Wyoming students, it will even reach out into the regional areas like Colorado, Montana, North Dakota. And I really think that that energy training that ours will focus on is really going to draw a lot of students from our Rocky Mountain area.
Yeah, would you talk a little bit about that, about how you'll be focused here?
Oh, yeah. We are going to be the only Job Corps center in the entire country that has an energy focus. And, of course, that's the makeup of our state. So we've been working with some key energy partners in making a production type of training for the students. And it's really going to be unique. There's going to be a classroom or a shop setting where they can see cutaways of how the production equipment works. And then the energy companies have designed an outside facility about the size of a football field. And the unique part of that is it'll be half oil and half gas. So if the students go to work in the natural gas, they'll have that experience. But if they go on the oil side, they'll also have that. And it's just going to be something that we just don't have in this state. And we can't even locate anything in the Rocky Mountains that looks like this kind of training.
Talking with Sandy Barton again, we're talking about the Wind River Job Corps and the center. The groundbreaking was on Friday morning, and this is something that I think I was in my 30s when we first did an interview on this, Sandy. It's been a while, hasn't it?
I think I was a lot younger, too. We, actually we started gathering information and research on this in 2005, and turned in the Wyoming application to the federal government in 2006 and got that great phone call from Senator Enzi in February of 2007 that Wyoming was successful in their application, along with two other states, which was Iowa and New Hampshire. So from that day, we started to celebrate, and we've never let down our excitement or enthusiasm of getting this built, which now we see it being built right now in Wyoming.
Do you anticipate there might be an opportunity to, for whatever reason, if the energy industry fades out, that you can do some other things there?
You know, that's a nice thing about Job Corps that I've learned is that they're really reactive to the needs of the industry, so they can change over the training to meet industry demands right away. So we don't want to think about energy ever going away or any of those other things, but Job Corps is really good about being proactive and customizing their training for the needs of the employers, because the idea is that we want to get these students hired into a self-sufficient wage job where they don't have to be on any kind of social services in the future.
I want to talk about, maybe in closing here, just a little bit about the reservation, maybe in particular, strikes me, because I think in our past conversations we've both alluded to that, you know, you've got poverty issues there with some of the younger folks. I'm wondering, as you've researched this and looked at this, how this might change that landscape.
I think it's really going to help, because this will be a place where the students can live. So if they're high school dropouts, if you've seen our statistics in Fremont County and the reservation, we have a high amount of dropouts. Statistics show that we don't have a lot of students that are graduating from high school on time in their cohorts. We have a lot of homeless youth. And so this will be an opportunity that they didn't have before that can change that landscape, that they'll have an opportunity to go to Job Corps. They can live there. They don't have to worry about three meals a day because it will be provided for them. They'll have a place to sleep, a safe place, an environment, and the training that they need so that they can have a hope in the future in whatever they plan to do. And they can go back to their reservation and they can work. There's many jobs there that this will be linked to, and they'll have a nice life.
You seem pretty excited.
I am. I couldn't be more excited about this. It's been a long time. It's a dream come true, not only to me, but a lot of educators that we just didn't have a choice. You know, I was a high school teacher for many years and ran into a lot of these youth that we didn't have an option. And we'd have to send them out of state to a Job Corps, and a lot of them didn't want to leave. And so now it's going to be right here in Wyoming. And so for our workforce leaders, myself, educators, this is a dream come true.
Sandy Barton is the executive director of Fremont County BOCES, and she was discussing the Wind River Job Corps.
Science has long been something we look to for answers. But when it comes to policymaking, science can't always provide the clear solutions lawmakers and the public want. And that has to do with how science works and the politics that sometimes infiltrate. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff reports that two issues in Wyoming demonstrate uncannily well the shortcomings of science when it comes to decision-making in the environmental sphere.
Remember that scene in Ghostbusters when Bill Murray's character is pursuing a seemingly irrelevant line of questioning with a laid-out woman as a concerned man stands by?
Are you, Alice, menstruating right now?
What has that got to do with it?
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
We have this reverence for science, this trust. But what if we can't always turn to science? What if science is sometimes as sleazy as Bill Murray in Ghostbusters? Who to trust then? In Wyoming, this is a very real question right now. Take, for example, the issue of contaminated water in Pavilion. The Environmental Protection Agency came out with a study tentatively linking the contamination in Pavilion to fracking. Industry and the state said EPA's study was flawed and are now starting work on their own study. If science is science, then why would the state's results be any different from the EPA's?
If science was science and it was independent, in other words, nobody had an interest in the outcome, then you're right, there's no problem.
That's Andrew Rosenberg, who directs the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
There is no methodology that is perfect. So if there are methodological issues, what might be the consequences of those methodological issues, and what would be a more appropriate way that would deal with those consequences? In other words, are there biases in the results or not? So do the independent review without conflict of interest, as opposed to backing away and handing it off to organizations that clearly have a conflict of interest.
Arguably, Wyoming has a vested interest in the production of oil and natural gas. But let's suppose, for argument's sake, that science is science after all. Even then, there are issues.
An honest scientific opinion is sometimes hard to come by because of the uncertainty.
Harold Bergman is a professor at the University of Wyoming. He says even in good science, there's the caveat of uncertainty. Something, by the way, that Pavilion has a lot of.
So within that range of uncertainty, what we tend to do as human beings or as regulatory bodies and sometimes as scientists, we tend to add our personal values or our government values to decide whether or not the answer is on this end of the uncertainty range or on that end of the uncertainty range.
And the interpretation of the uncertainty could be ripe for politicking. Take, for example, another issue in the state. Encana Oil and Gas is asking for an exemption to be able to pump wastewater into the Madison Aquifer. Encana modeled the process and concluded that it would be safe. Then, the Powder River Basin Resource Council, an environmental group whose agenda is quite different from Encana's, contracted Tom Myers, an independent hydrologist, to review Encana's work, which he did, and tentatively concluded it was not so safe. But
remember, I mean, my study is a very cursory examination using some very basic numbers.
There's a reason Myers' analysis was cursory.
I cannot say whether Encana is correct or not correct, because there is just no transparency to what they did.
Everybody agrees that science needs to be transparent to be trustworthy. Rosenberg of the Center for Science and Democracy also says any science needs to be peer-reviewed, something neither Encana nor the state have committed to in either the Pavilion work or the Madison Aquifer exemption modeling. So where does this leave policymakers and the public? Do they trust the EPA's work when deciding on policy? The states? Encana's? Myers? Bergman says how we use our science is a philosophical question. Europe, he says, uses the precautionary principle, which leans towards absolute protection when there isn't enough information.
In the United States, by law, almost all of our environmental regulatory laws rely instead on risk analysis or risk-benefit analysis. And so there we're trying to get enough information to be able to make a parsed judgment about the probability of something being bad.
Risk-benefit analysis requires a lot of data. Sometimes so much, everyone will privately tell you that it's not feasible to obtain. That might just be the case in Pavilion. So the uncertainty could remain a crutch both sides can lean on there. Meanwhile, data or no data, regulations still have to be made. Former Governor Dave Friedenthal says the dance between politicians and scientists is an ongoing one.
The availability of scientific information is desirable, but it isn't always present when you have to make the decision. And sometimes what you do is you make the decision on the best available information. And you see that in the environmental area, best available control technology, maximum achievable control technology. What you see is an admission that public policy and science move at different rates.
Friedenthal oversaw the sage-grouse saga in the state and implemented rules to protect the bird. He says they used the best available science, knowing it wasn't perfect.
The difficulty is that public policy and emotions may move faster than science. The other thing is that public policy and politics want clearly black and white answers. Science tends to be shades of gray.
And sometimes that gray gets even murkier when special interests are involved. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Each year, millions of dollars are spent controlling invasive species in Wyoming. Just about every agency you can think of is involved, from local weed and pest districts to the Department of Game and Fish, and even the Bureau of Land Management. Many people see their efforts as an important way to protect Wyoming's diversity. But others worry that removing invasives could sometimes do more harm than good. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Dee Hilberry owns a farm just outside Thermopolis. His porch overlooks grassy fields and the Bighorn River. But it didn't always look like this.
3 years ago, standing in this spot, you could not see the river.
That's because a type of tree called Russian olives had taken over the riverbanks and many of the surrounding fields. That blocked the view and meant there was less and less land available for growing crops. Plus, unwanted animals started showing up, like raccoons and skunks.
One year, between the raccoons and the white-tailed deer, we lost 38% of our corn crop.
Russian olives are not native to Wyoming, but they used to be seen as a good thing. In the 1800s, people planted them as ornamental trees and to block the wind. But then they started spreading, fast. Amy Anderson with the Wyoming Game and Fish Department says that's when they became a problem.
They tend to use more water than native species. They create assemblages that make it very difficult to use the river, either recreationally or in agriculture. And they spread really quickly and choke out our native species.
They also change the salt content of the soil. All of that means the ecosystem loses diversity. And Anderson says that makes those areas less attractive to certain types of wildlife, including sage grouse. Those are some of the reasons she's been coordinating a massive effort to remove Russian olives and another invasive species called salt cedar in the Bighorn Basin. So far, about 15,000 acres have been cleared. But some think removal is misguided. Bruce Osterman is one of them.
I think it's a heck of a good tree, and it grows where nothing else will grow.
Osterman owns property just down the river from Dee Hilberry's farm. His riverbank is shaded by a dense grove of Russian olives. But across the river, the landscape is bare. The invasive trees were cut down this spring and stacked into huge brush piles. Osterman says the lack of shade seems to be warming the river and affecting fish.
Most of the time we're worried about deforestation, and here we're deforesting the entire Bighorn Basin.
Anderson and her team are trying to replant native species like cottonwoods and willows, but getting the natives to regrow is not always successful. Russian olives are just one of many invasive species that Wyoming is trying to control. There are dozens of other plants and some non-native fish that are also being targeted. Sometimes it's because they choke out important natives. Sometimes they increase the risk of wildfires. Other times they're toxic to livestock. Removing the invaders can help lessen those negative impacts. One project was so successful that it helped keep a rare type of trout off the endangered species list. But some ecologists urge caution.
Not all non-native species are a net detriment, and some of them may provide benefits that in some cases outweigh the costs.
Dove Sachs is an ecologist at Brown University who studies how species invasions impact native ecosystems. He points out that honeybees are not native to the U.S., but they provide important services. Similarly, some non-native plants can clean pollutants out of wetlands. Even the salt cedar that Wyoming is removing has been useful in the southwestern U.S. to provide habitat for endangered bird species. So Sachs says it's not always worth spending a lot of money to get rid of something just because it's non-native.
Especially if it's already established in an area and would be expensive to remove or try to remove, then the question is it worth spending money to try to do this? And if we were to be successful, would we have net outcomes that were good for conservation as a consequence, or might there actually be net costs?
In the end, decisions regarding invasive species management often come down to value judgments. Brian Mueller with the University of Wyoming Extension says it's often the ag industry that drives initiatives to remove invasive species. But he says in this case, environmental advocates are often on board.
And I think oftentimes one of the reasons why people can get behind invasive species management efforts is because it can benefit all of those interests. It's not really an either-or situation.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll hear one Pinedale resident's story about growing up on the Wyoming frontier in the 1920s and 30s. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This summer, StoryCorps set up a booth in Cheyenne to record Wyomingites interviewing one another and sharing their stories. Today, we'll hear from 95-year-old Pinedale native Guy Decker, better known as Bud. Decker tells his longtime friend Jim Lotta about what it was like to grow up on the Wyoming frontier.
I was born on the Muleshoe Ranch, and a dentist delivered me. There was no doctor available.
And you lost your mother at a young age.
My mother died when I was 5 years old, and my dad raised me from then on.
And you had a sister?
I had a sister, one sister, Dorothy, which was 13 months older than I am and meaner than a junkyard dog.
It's good that we record that.
Oh, so,
you told a story about before you were potty trained, your dad had a elk mount.
Oh, yeah, Dad had a bull elk mount on hanging on the wall, and there was a spike in the wall right by it, and I had a habit of messing my pants, I guess, when I was 3 or 4 or 5 years old. Dad had hanged me on that damn nail next to that elk bull head, and I was scared to death of that damn thing, and I think it finally probably broke me and messed my pants.
So that's potty training at its best, yeah. So you had a lot of experiences growing up in Tulsa and LaBarge. Talk about your school experience. How'd all that work?
Okay. Well, we went to school there at LaBarge through grade school, and we got along fine. And then I started school at Big Piney, and in my junior year, I got kicked out of the Big Piney school.
What'd you do to get kicked out, bud?
Well, the first thing we did, we took November the 11th, and we saw a sign in the bank said legal holiday. So Jim, I can't think of his name, he and I said, well, hell, if it's a holiday for the bank, it'll be a holiday for us. So we took off, and Dad had to come up from LaBarge to Big Piney to get me back in school. Well, he'd been up there two or three times already, and when I called him, he was really mad. In the meantime, I'd done too many mischievous things around the school, and they wouldn't let me back in.
When you got kicked out finally, didn't you go up to Lozier's for the winter?
Well, Dad had a coal contract to furnish all the little schools. In those days, they didn't have buses, so they had little schools scattered all over. Well, Dad had a contract to furnish the coal, so he put me to work hauling the coal to all these schools. And I thought he was working me too hard, and he wouldn't even speak to me. He's so mad at me for getting kicked out. So I packed my pillowcase with my clothes, had 55 cents in my pocket, and hitched a ride to Big Piney. And I knew the Loziers, so they took me out to the ranch, and they had sickness in the family. So they gave me the job of feeding the cattle on that ranch. So I batched on that ranch when I was 15 years old and fed the cattle there until spring, until April.
You were glad when spring got here, though?
Yeah, I was glad, but it was a good experience. And then when spring came, I was looking for work. And do you know Norm Barlow?
Yes.
I worked for Norm, moving cattle. And we had to night herd the cattle, so I got some experience night herding the cattle.
Pretty lonesome, isn't it?
Yeah. Then in about the last of August, Dad came up and asked me if I wouldn't go back to school. And I'll tell you, I had my pillowcase packed before he got out of sight.
Why were you excited to get back to school after you had a layoff?
Well, I'll tell you, when you're working on your own, nobody to give you directions or anything, and you're 15 years old, and your dad had always been good to you, and I was anxious to get back home.
Getting his good graces,
yeah,
right?
That was Bud Decker talking about growing up on the Wyoming frontier in the 1920s and 30s. He spoke with his friend of 40 years, Jim Latta. The piece was produced by Rebecca Martinez with interviews recorded at StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
Today, we finish with the occasional segment called Mountain West Voices with Clay Scott. Today, he focuses on Laramie's Paul Taylor.
When Paul Taylor was growing up in Adelaide, South Australia in the 1960s, he was taught to conform. The tie of his school uniform was always neatly knotted, and his teachers reprimanded him if his white socks were not pulled all the way up. But that was a long time ago.
I went through an incredible change, and I graduated as a social worker out of the University of South Australia, and I went to the outback. And I my work gave me direct access to the oldest or the oldest living cultural history in the world. These are the people who really do think differently about the world. And they left a feeling with me just hanging out with them that I didn't get growing up in the suburbs of Adelaide. I came from a big, happy family, five sisters, four brothers. And there was a sense of joy and security that I got from these people that I felt in my belly.
Some of the friendships Paul made in these remote Aboriginal communities have lasted a lifetime. More than anything, he says, he was affected by the deep and intimate connection to place among people who'd been living on the same land for millennia. Ironically, after he quit his job as a social worker, Paul began a phase of his life in which he deliberately uprooted himself from everything familiar. He sold everything he had and went to Europe, where he made his living as a circus clown. A few years later, when he was briefly back in Australia, an American named Bobby Bridger hired him as a guide for several weeks. Bridger was touring Australia with a one-man show about the American West, and he and Paul became friends.
He said, come to America. He says, I'll put you in buckskins. I'll make you a mountain man. So he took me all the way up to Cody, Wyoming. I came over in 1990. He put me in his show, and I was touring around Yellowstone as a mountain man. I had a silver fox on my head, and I had my didgeridoo with me. I was playing it to make bear sounds for the show. We had the show, and we reenacted the famous bear mauling of Hugh Glass. And you didn't see the didgeridoo, but you could hear it, and so I came out and I fell in love with the Rocky Mountains. There's nothing like that in Australia. So that was the beginning of my American journey, and I'm still here.
Paul's lived in Laramie, Wyoming now for 20 years. He's made a living as a teacher and a musician and a professional storyteller. He visits schools all over the Rocky Mountain West, and while he's in love with the American West, he loves to teach American kids about Australia.
The lizard man loved to throw. He threw and threw as the people watched and watched. The boomerang circled above and around them again and again. Their bodies. It's a juggle, because I've created this lifestyle where I'm actually teaching about my homeland, but I'm living here. And then I go back. I create, and in a way, I consciously created the project as a way of keeping my connection to my homeland.
Paul is referring to the Yubelyawan Dreaming Project, a phenomenally ambitious documentation of Wardaman Aboriginal culture, song, art, language, stories, and ecology. For more than 10 years, Paul has returned to North Australia every year to collect material under the direction of Wardaman elder Bill Harney.
It's what he wants to share as the custodian of the culture. As he's the last male custodian, which means he's the last male fully initiated elder that's gone through ceremony. And there would normally be a whole series of elders, like teachers that went through and took the kids through all these different levels of caring for the land. That's what it was all about, teaching them about caring for the land. They did it through singing it, dancing it, painting it, and then putting it all in theatre. They were practicing theatre with the landscape for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that's how they kept the life force going. And if you don't do that, if we don't do that, then the land will die, and we will die with it.
You've been listening to Mountain West Voices. Our series is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. The singing and playing of Wardaman elder Bill Harney was provided by Paul Taylor and used with permission. To learn more about the work of Paul Taylor and the Yubelyawan Dreaming Project, go to mountainwestvoices.org. I'm Clay Scott.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and very important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.